Have a recorder, so you know if everything fails, we'll at least have that.
Okay.
Thank you. As was just said, Mrs. Scheer is being sponsored really by two people. One is Jody Feld is sponsoring the Scheer in memory of her mother, Golda Bashprinsadino, Mayor Alicia. This is the fourth Yahrzeit, and we have a co-sponsor, a very close friend of the Feld family, Noach Bittelman, who's here from Chutz Laaretz, in memory of his wife Tamar Basoded. It's the first Yahrzeit, so Hashem should give you much nechama, and we hope that these words of Torah should be le'ilui nishmatam, and should be a zechus for all of Klal Yisrael. First, happy Tu B'Shvat. The co-sponsors were kind enough to also supply you with the special peiros that people eat on Tu B'Shvat, including the wine. I'll talk about that a little bit. And indeed, for those who want, indeed, we will hold a Ma'ariv Minyan, if you want, but it'll be in the library, one floor up. Okay. Anyway, I was asked, because it is Tu B'Shvat, I was asked to, by the sponsors, to make a one-time special exception. It wasn't part of our regular schedule, but to talk a little bit about Tu B'Shvat, but not just Tu B'Shvat, but also to talk about some halachos about Judaism and the environment, as it were. And the idea that to be a religious Jew means you should be a green Jew to some degree as well. So I want to talk about it both halachically and a little bit kabbalistically, although I know that Jody is having a Tu B'Shvat Seder tomorrow, and Sarah Yehuda Schneider, who will talk about much more of the Kabbalah aspects than I will. Let me first start off, though, with the idea that the month of Shvat as a whole, not just Tu B'Shvat, is really devoted to the notion of sanctifying the physical and animal impulses within man. You know, we are a body and a soul, and although we stress our neshama is the most important thing, but Judaism does teach that our encounter with the physical, we don't believe in a duality. We don't say physical bad, spiritual good. But rather, the very teaching of Judaism is that one can spiritualize and elevate even the most physical of activities, the most animalistic of activities. And there's a remez to this. You know, the earliest Kabbalistic work that we have is said to be Sefer Yetzira, the book of creation, whose author is either Avraham Avinu or perhaps Adam HaRishon himself. And Sefer Yetzira, you can even get an English translation, it describes how Hashem combined, like DNA, all the letters of the Aleph base to create the various parts of the universe. And as a result, every single month is connected to both a letter of the Aleph base, obviously sometimes more than one letter, obviously, and a certain sensory function. So in for the month of Shvat, this is what the passage says. Himlich os tzadik bila'ita. A bit of an obscure phrase. God made the letter tzadik a king over the word le'ita. Now, what is the word le'ita? Le'ita is a Hebrew word. If you remember, this appears when Esav shows up after hunting a whole day, and Esav sees Yaakov cooking this very delicious cholent, or this lentil soup, at Dashim, and he says to Yaakov, Haliteini na! Min ha-dam, ha-dam, ha-dam. He's so hungry, he doesn't even know what it is. Give me that red stuff. Whatever it is, it smells good, it looks good. Haliteini na is a gluttonous eating. Pour it down my gullet. The word malitin in the Mishnah is when you force feed an animal, you stuff it down their throat. So li'ita is ravenous, gluttonous, pressing food consumption in a ravenous way, like an animal. So, human beings, generally, we are capable of all sorts of animal-like behaviors, uncontrolled passions, whether it's for food, for sexual intercourse, for money, whatever it is, we sometimes have passions that rule us and control us. But the month of Shvat teaches us that the tzaddik, the letter tzaddik, is also symbolic of the righteous person, is able to take the animal passions and direct them and channel them. And as we will see, indeed, our involvement in the physical world is a way that we connect to Hashem. So as opposed, let's say, to Catholic theology that sees in the world a certain dichotomy, the spiritual is holy and the physical needs to be avoided, that's why there's celibacy, that is why there's poverty, officially oaths of poverty, because the world will drag you down. Judaism very much believes that our role is to elevate the physical, sanctify the physical. And the very first mitzvah of the Torah is to be fruitful and multiply, to create homes and to create relationships and the like. So the whole month of Shabbat is devoted to confronting the physical and elevating it and sanctifying it. Now, in particular, what are the halachic origins of Tu B'Shvat? The halachic origins of Tu B'Shvat are surprisingly modest. And that is, the only reference to the 15th of Shvat in the Mishnah is a technical law regarding trumos and masros. What do I mean? Trumos and masros, you have to take off from the produce of Eretz Yisrael, you have to take off your tithings, and different years have different tithings. So for example, a Shemitah, of course, is patur from everything, but for example, in year one and year two, 10% of your crop would be brought to Yerushalayim and eaten. That would be called the second maser. Today, because we're Tameh, we don't do that. But for year three, instead of taking that 10% and bringing it to Yerushalayim, you would give it to the poor as maser ani. So year one, two, four, and five of the Shemitah cycle, the second tithe, the first tithe goes to the Levi every year, that's maser rishon, but the second tithe would be eaten in Yerushalayim, year one, two, four, and five. Year three and six, you would distribute it to the poor to be eaten wherever they want. That's called maser ani. Now the question becomes, how do you determine what year a crop belongs to? So for trees, for fruits, there's a special rule that a fruit is allocated not to the year that you harvested it, it is allocated to the year that it budded. That is called chanata. So if a fruit budded in the second year, even if it did not ripen and was not harvested until the third year, it would be a maser sheni fruit rather than a maser ani fruit. Budding. But then we have a second rule, that the definition of a year for a tree is not Rosh Hashanah, but it's the 15th of Shavat. And that is the meaning of the phrase Rosh Hashanah le'ilanot. It simply means that for Trumos and Masros, the start of a tree's year is not Tishrei, but it's the 15th of Shvat. Therefore, if a tree budded, or if a fruit budded before the 15th of Shvat, let's say this year, if you had a fruit that budded, well, this year is Shemitah, it doesn't count, but let's say it would be not a Shemitah year. If a fruit budded before the 15th of Shvat, even if it's after Rosh Hashanah, it belongs to the old year in terms of what maser you take. And if it budded after 15th of Shvat, it belongs to the new year. That's all. There is no mention of a holiday, no mention of a celebration, no mention of anything. It is simply a technical law regarding the allocation of what year a fruit belongs to, based on this. So the first mention of things being festive comes from the Gaonim. This is already after the Gemara. And they make the point that Tu B'Shvat is mentioned together with three other Rosh Hashanahs. There are four Rosh Hashanahs, including what we call Rosh Hashanah. And just as the first Rosh Hashanah of Tishrei is festive, so too all the other Rosh Hashanahs are festive, and as a result, the Gaonim say, you don't say Tachanun on Tu B'Shvat. Okay, that's a pretty modest holiday observance. But that's it. Again, no mention of fruits, no mention of a Seder. So Tu B'Shvat exploded, really, in the time of the Arizal, the great Kabbalists of Tzfat, and the Talmidim of the Arizal created a whole ceremony which has become very popular. Sfardim have been doing this ever since the Arizal. It's been a long, long time. Sfardic Minhagim, Hasidim picked it up among the Litvisha. It was not so popular, but part of that might be because you really couldn't get many types of fruits in Poland during the winter. That's why Karpas became potato. You wonder, gee, why would the Karpas for the Seder be a potato? Because that's kind of what you got, you know, in Poland, even during Pesach times. In recent years, though, Tu B'Shvat Seder has become very popular. I mean, part of it, even among Jews who aren't religious, they like the ceremony, and it's become part of a celebration of environmentalism, which, again, is not a totally bad thing. But let me just explain where this Tu B'Shvat Seder comes from. The Arizal taught that Tu B'Shvat, when we say it's the new year of a tree, the Chumash tells us, Ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh, a human being is also a tree. We are like a tree. Adam eitz ha'sadeh. We are like a tree in a lot of ways. Just as the mighty oak can grow from that little seed, so too a human being physically grows from a drop of the sperm uniting with the egg, but spiritually as well. We come into the world with so much potential in that newborn baby that can be unlocked and that can be realized. We are like an upside-down tree. A physical tree has its roots on earth and it reaches up to Shamayim. We are people who are rooted in Shamayim who come into the earth. And therefore the Rosh Hashanah of the tree is a Rosh Hashanah for us as well. But in what way is it a Rosh Hashanah for us? Our Rosh Hashanah was Rosh Hashanah. Tishrei. How is Tu B'Shvat a Rosh Hashanah for us? So there's a thought from the Chidushei Harim, the first Gera Rebbe, who says very beautifully that the Gemara tells us that why is Tu B'Shvat the technical Rosh Hashanah for fruit? The reason is because by Tu B'Shvat, most of the rain of the season has already come, because we have Cheshvan, the rainy season in Israel is Cheshvan to Nisan. So you have Cheshvan, Kislev, Teves, Shvat. Most of the Geshamim have already fallen in a normal year. So it says, any tree that budded before Tu B'Shvat primarily got its nourishment from last year's rains. But any tree that buds after Tu B'Shvat has gotten its nourishment and its sap from this year's rains. And that's why it belongs to the new year. The Chiddush Yerim says, rain, Geshem, is a symbol of the divine influences that God puts into our lives. And here is this concept. Every Rosh Hashanah, Hashem determines what our spiritual potentialities are for the coming year. So that's given to us on Rosh Hashanah, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. But we don't draw upon that new Geshem till Tu B'Shvat, which means, although it is allocated to us on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we are still living off last year's Shefa until Tu B'Shvat. Tu B'Shvat, the treasury that has been allocated to us, is now open. Now, it might be less, right? It doesn't necessarily mean more, but it's new. And the Chiddush Yerim says, a spiritually sensitive person will feel the difference in their Avodas Hashem pre-Tu B'Shvat and after Tu B'Shvat. Because pre-Tu B'Shvat, we are living off the spiritual gifts of Rosh Hashanah, Tafshin, Ayin, Dalet. Post-Tu B'Shvat, we are living off the spiritual gifts of Tafshin, Ayin, Hei. So in many ways, it's a time of great, great potential renewal, and that's Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh, that we are in Eitz. Now, the Tu B'Shvat said, I'm not going to go over all the details, but the essential idea is that the Chet of Adam HaRishon, which brought all of the evil into the world, was a kilkel in achila. Hashem commanded the person not to eat, and he ate. So we want to be mesaken, the chet of Adam HaRishon, by taking the very instrumentality through which he sinned, and elevating it by making brachos, by sanctifying it, by releasing the sparks of holiness in the food, by the brachos. And that is a great, great tikkun. That is a tikkun, the Ari said, of the chet of Adam HaRishon that brings holiness and goodness into the world. There is a, just like income tax has a short form and a long form, right, an American income tax, 1040 and 1040A. So there is the short form Tu B'Shvat Seder and the long form Tu B'Shvat Seder. The short form says you eat 12 types of fruit. It's interesting, the Shivas Aminim, although they're in there, but we go beyond the Shivas Aminim. And the long form says you eat 30 types of fruits. The more common custom is the 30, and I'll just tell you very bekitzer what it's based on. The 12, the number 12 is very significant. Number one, of course, obviously there are 12 Shiftei Yisrael. But there's another aspect of 12 as well, and that is the Shem Havaya, Yudke Vavke, the four letters of God's name, because two of the letters are the same. There are two Hays, so there's really only three distinct letters, can be arranged in 12 combinations. Yudke Vavke is the Midah of Rachamim. But this Rachamim can manifest itself in many different configurations, and the number would be 12. In fact, each year, if you look at some Siddurim, you will actually see Al Pi Kabbalah, every single month has a different Siruf of the letters of the Shem Havaya. Meaning Hashem's Rachamim comes in different channels and in different ways. And according to the Mekubalim, different fruits are identified with different tserufim of the Shem Havaya, and that is where you get the number 12, as if to say we want to access every possible channel of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's mercy. Shem Havaya is the Shem of Divine Mercy. The basis of the 30 is a bit more complex, and the 30 is divided into three groups of 10 fruits each. Group one are fruits that are totally edible. There is no peel and there is no pit. Right? You can eat the whole fruit. Group two is edible on the outside, but it has an inedible pit, like an avocado, an adama. You include adama here, and a peach. And group three are fruits that have an inedible klipa, such as an orange or the like. And the concept of this is the following. And you have 10 of each group. 10, totally edible. 10, edible on the outside with inedible pit. And 10, with an inedible klipa. 10 is the number of creation. Hashem created the universe with 10 mamarot. So 10 is the completion of creation. But in Kabbalah, it is taught, there are four different worlds. There is the world of pure spirituality, which is the world of emanation, called the world of Atzilus. In other words, the concept though that the Mekubalim have is that just like an architect, in fact, this is a very simple analogy. An architect initially thinks about a design, but that exists only in the world of thought. Then there is a blueprint. Then there's a sketch. The sketch is a preliminary design. It's a bit more concretized. Then there is a blueprint. And then there is a physical building that is built. Meaning to say, the physical world that we have goes through a number of stages. Of course, in Hashem's case, everything happens simultaneously. But from the world of pure thought and spirituality to progressively more concretization. Now, in that process of concretization, the spirituality gets trapped. It becomes less visible and less apparent. And these four worlds, going from the highest to the lowest, we're in the lowest, is Atzilus, the world of emanation, Berea, the world of creation, Yetzira, the world of formation, and we, where you have the physical table, this is the world of Asiya. So the abbreviation, it's a very common abbreviation in Sifrei Kabbalah and Machshava, is Avya, Aleph, Beis, Yud, Ayin. Atzilus, Berea, Yetzira, Asiya. Again, without getting too academic, Kabbalah is sometimes described, although we believe it's much more than that, as a form of Neoplatonism. And indeed, it corresponds very much with Plato's, Lahavdil's idea that there exist spiritual ideals of which the physical world is just an approximate concretization. So yes, there's a physical table, but that's only because there's a spiritual ideal of a table that is abstracted from the physical. That's exactly the idea of Mekubalim in the world of Atzilus culminating into Asiya. Of course, what do they tell? They tell the story about Rav Chaim Sanzer, or the Sanzer Rav, was once speaking, Suda Shlishis, and he started coughing, he had an awful hacking cough. So his son brought him a cup of tea, and he was very impatient. He says, I'm mechubber to the world of Atzilus right now. I'm connecting myself not through Asiya, I'm connecting directly to Atzilus. In Atzilus, we don't drink tea. So his son said, in Atzilus, you don't cough either. He said, so you're in the world of Asiya. So here is the Kabbalistic idea, though. The Kabbalistic idea is that certain fruits, if a fruit is totally edible, the edible part of the fruit is the spiritual essence, because that is absorbed in the body, which feeds the neshama. So he says that the fruits that are more spiritual come from a higher shorish. So those that are totally edible, what we're doing is we're bringing the shefa of Hashem down from Atzilus to the next world. Those that have an inedible core, but the Kedusha breaks out, so to speak, the core cannot contain the Kedusha, they come, we're bringing the Shefa down from Bria to Yetzira, and those Peris that are most physical, that's surrounded with an inedible Klipa that contains, it blocks the Shefa from coming out, that is the final stage in which we take the Kedusha and we bring it into the Olam Ho'asiyah. And the way we liberate this holiness is by making brachos, and that's why, again, the Tu B'Shvat Seder is a complicated protocol, because it's important that there be a bracha on every single fruit, but you got a big problem there, because once you make one ha'etz, that covers all the fruits. Once you make one ha'adama, that covers all the vegetables. So how do you do it? See, there's a very complicated timing procedure in which not everybody makes all the brachas, not everybody eats all the fruits, because we have to specifically arrange that each person, there will be a bracha on each fruit, and that liberates the sparks of holiness. I just want to point out that the Arizal has an amazing teaching. Everyone knows the well-known Gemara, that anyone who eats without a bracha is as if they have stolen. And the simple meaning is, Hashem owns everything. So if you don't make a bracha, you're not given permission to eat, so you're a ganav. Right? That's the pashut pshat. But the Arizal translates it this way. If you eat without a bracha, you have stolen from the world the holiness that the bracha releases. And therefore, it's not Hashem that you've stolen from. You've stolen from the Olam by not releasing the sparks of holiness that are within the fruit. Again, if you go to a Tu B'Shvat Seder, you'll hear much more about this. That's why, along with the brachos, we recite Psukim of Tanakh and Zohar, Gemara, Chazal, Zohar, about these particular fruits. And a final minhag that's connected with Tu B'Shvat Seder, and this year will not be totally about this, is that the Talmidei HaRi did add a ritual of 4 cups of wine, similar to Pesach. But what is that? But it's an interesting progression. You start with white wine, and you progressively add some drops of red. So the second cup, a little red, added to the white. Third cup, more red. Fourth cup, a lot of red, so the whole cup looks basically red. You go from white to red. Now, there is a modern environmentalist take that likes to say, this is the change of seasons. White is the winter. Okay, but that's not what the Mekubalim say. The Mekubalim have a totally different imagery. And they say that white is Midas HaRachamim, and red is Midas HaDin. And as you progress to a more and more physical world, from Atsilas to Asiya, unfortunately, what often happens is there is Hester Panim, there is concealment of the divine. God's mercy becomes more and more concealed by the appearance of red. But we have to know that even with all the red, the Sheirish, what was in there initially, is the Rachamim. So as we go from Atsilas to Asiya, we have the Rachamim gets covered up, it gets mechusa, it gets less visible. The red is more and more dominant, but the white is still there. And that reminds us, therefore, that even when life is difficult, we should strive to identify the Rachamim of Hashem, the Chaste Hashem, and the like. So those are some of the minhagim that are connected to B'Shvat. Again, you'll notice that there is no particular chashivas here to the 7 minim. Now, it is true that the 7 minim are included in both the list of 12 and the list of 30, but under both lists, you are including things that go beyond them. So the shivas haminim are not necessarily given any unique chashivas in the Tu B'Shvat ritual. We either have the 12, which are the yud beis seirufim of the Shem Havaya, or the 30 that represents the kedusha of coming from Atsilas to Bria, from Bria to Yetzira to Asi. Okay, so that's a little bit about the Tu B'Shvat Seder. But generally, the concept of thinking about nature is a very, very significant thing. You know, for really more than 2,000 years, Jews have been predominantly urban creatures. Until we came back to Eretz Israel, in many places in Europe, Jews were not even allowed to own land. And that's why they went into business, they lived in cities and the like. But if you go back to the Torah itself, the Torah clearly envisioned a society that was largely agricultural. The Sholosh Regalim, which we define primarily, we look at Pesach as Zman Cheruseinu, Yetzias Mitzrayim, and Shavuos is Matan Torah, and Sukkos is the aftermath of Yom Kippur. But in the Torah emphasizes very much the agricultural aspects of these Yomim Tovim. Right? Pesach is Chodesh Aviv, the month of the ripening of the grain, the beginning of the spring. Shavuos is the Katsir, the harvesting of the wheat. And Sukkos is the ingathering of the fruits after a long summer where they were allowed to dry. And the concept was that through looking at nature, one had a greater appreciation for the kindness of Hashem, the Chaste Hashem. Even the idea of tefillah cycle, the notion that you pray Shacharis, ideally Kvasikin, when the sun rises. And I've said very often that we've ruined Vasikin. If you ever go to a Vasikin minyan, you will look that people stare obsessively at some atomic clock. Sunrise is supposed to be exactly, down to some hundredth of a second, and you're 200th of a second off. I once had to daven on a yard site and a Vasikin minyan. I thought they were going to pull me off in the middle, because I think I was off by 5 seconds for this. But Vasikin is not about the clock. They didn't measure time that accurately, in the time of Chazal. Vasikin is about joining the wonderful symphony of creation as it praises Hashem. As the sun rises, what does David HaMelech say? Yira'ucha im HaShemesh. We will revere you, Hashem, together with the sun. And in the Arvis, as the sun was setting, even Mincha ideally is supposed to be daven, not after sunset, but as the sun is going down. And Maariv, when the sky is filled with stars, you look up and you say, Ma enosh ki siskarenu. Who is man? You know, that should have any significance. That nature is supposed to inspire us with the godless habore, the chachma of Hashem, the love of Hashem, the magnificence of Hashem's universe. And it affects our heart. A Jew is a person that is inspired by the natural cycles. Our calendar is based on the moon. You know, I always had this question from the time I was a child. Hashem tells Avraham, your children will be as numerous as the stars of the sky. So I go outside, I look at how many stars do you see in the sky? Not too many. I mean, five stars, like, what's the big deal? But then I was once in Amuka. And I look up, hey, you know, there are like a million stars up there. I didn't even know that. So the truth of the matter is, you know, we've taken everything. Vasikin, we look at the clock. Mincha will daven, you know, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Maariv, you know, we'll do Mincha and Maariv right after each other. We're not attuned to nature. We're not inspired by nature. And as a result, there's a whole dimension in our spirituality that is very defective. It's very chaser. Because we no longer look to the natural world as a source of chizuk and a source of inspiration. When in fact, the Rambam writes lahalacha in the Mishnah Torah, that one of the ways that one comes to Avas Hashem is when he contemplates the niflos habayre, the wonderful creation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Torah and Teva are two ways that one understands the godless HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And again, we've been very, very bereft of that connection. In fact, now, Pirkei Avos says like this. Pirkei Avos says that if a person, hamafsik mimishnasei, a person stops his learning, v'yomar, and he says, ma noa ilon zeh, how beautiful is that tree? Pirkei Avos says, harei zeh mischayev, he deserves to die. So that seems to indicate we're not supposed to look at the trees, right? But there's a Hasidic word. Now, you may accept it or not, but it's a Hasidic word. Gvaldik a Hasidic word. They say the Avla is he stopped his learning, meaning his contemplation of the tree was not connected to his Avodas Hashem. If you treat it like an interruption, Mischayev Benafshe. But if Lehepech, if I look at the tree and it's part of my learning about the godless Hashem, then it's a good thing, right? The problem is you're mafsik, mishnasik. What are brachos about? Rabbi Victor Miller has a very famous, very, very famous, you might call it meditation on a banana. In one of his books, he writes about what should a person think about when he eats a banana. And he talks about the texture and the packaging and the color and the aromas are for apples or bananas. And this is actually based on a much earlier makor, the Chovos HaLevavos. Actually, it was not as dramatic as Rav Miller, but the Chovos HaLevavos actually talks about this idea. But Rav Miller goes on for like 10 pages. What you think about. And then you make the bracha. And then you say, thank you, Hashem, for creating such beauty in the world. I knew a mashgiach, a certain American mashgiach, when he wanted to teach his children to make brachos. He had a very interesting chinuch, like a four-year-old. Instead of teaching them make a bracha, which they could do, he wanted them to internalize the idea of a bracha. And since Hebrew was not their first language, he says, when you pick up the apple, say thank you to Hashem. And try to say why. Why are you thankful to Hashem? What are you thanking Hashem for? And the child learned, you know, it tastes so good, you know, it smells so good, it's so pretty. And he wanted his children to say that. And then, after they did that for a while, he said, okay, so now we say it in Hebrew. This way. So when the child said a bracha, it wasn't just a thing that he did, but it was connected to the notion of hakara satov, based on the beauty that Hashem put into the world. And the Chovos HaLevavos says, a Jew needs to be attuned to beauty as well. Because Hashem could have done, if the purpose was simply to keep us alive, Hashem could have made everything without color, like kind of the, army food or whatever it is, you know. Everything just has no taste. You know, you don't need taste, you don't need color, you don't need texture, you don't need music. I mean, none of these things are necessary for survival. But Hashem put beauty into the world to give us simcha and to give us appreciation and to give us hakaras hatov. So these are the things that we think about during this time, and that's a very, very important idea, to try to not to be monotic ourselves so much from the world of nature. Now, I just want to mention relatively quickly that Rav Soloveitchik used to say, there is no authentic Jewish philosophy that is not rooted in the concepts of halacha. Meaning sometimes people say, I'm Jewish and I'm a philosopher, therefore what I say is Jewish philosophy. That's not at all true. Jewish philosophy ultimately has to be based on the halachos of Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebal Peh. And by examining the halachos, we try to have, what is the word that the YU people are so fond of, the Weltanschauung, right? The world view. That, I don't know if that's the right pronunciation. Okay, that's the very fond of that phrase, of kind of looking at the pratim, looking at the details, and trying to construct a philosophy. Rav Soloveitchik's point is indeed very valid, that the hashkafa you have is not stam as a, you know, some hashkafa on life, but I look at the halachas and I create a hashkafa. But that's not so simple often, because often the halacha expresses itself as many, many different details, and you don't always see a unified idea. That's where Agadita actually comes in. But I just want to go very, very quickly that there are many, many inyanim of halacha that are makasher ourselves to a sensitivity to the environment and the physical world that we inhabit. And let me just mention, Bekitzer, that the two halachas that are most obvious is one is the law of Bal Tashchis, that the Torah says that when you wage war against the city, you cannot destroy the fruit-bearing trees. And Chazal, through the Torah Shebal Peh, generalized that this is not just a principle about fruit-bearing trees, although that is the strictest application of Lo Tashchis, but it applies to any wanton destruction of resources, because when you destroy and waste what Hashem has put into the world, you are showing that you don't appreciate what Hashem has given you. And this is Bal Tashchis, and this would certainly argue in favor of conservation and recycling and various other ways in which things don't go to waste. Now, there's another set of halachas, which is actually one of the most complicated sugyas in Shas. Rav Aaron Cutler was meforsam for his shiurim in this. This is the Perek Lo Yachbor, the second Perek of Bava Basra. And the second Perek of Bava Basra deals with the whole mitzvah in halacha that is Dinei Shechenim, or Hacharkas Nezikim. And that is, I have an obligation not to use my property in a way that hurts other people. That even if I'm a Bailam, I have ownership of property, but Lo Yachbor delineates how you cannot use your property in ways that hurt other people. And there's a very, very complicated sugyas, but just to give you a few examples, there are halachas that certain industries must be distant from the residential areas because of odors, air pollution, water pollution, noise pollution, even things like bringing in traffic into a residential area. There are zoning restrictions. So these are harchakas nesikin, meaning do not use your property in ways that will bring injury on others. So at a very early date, going back to the Torah Shebal Peh of the Mishnah, we were already concerned with pollution, primarily as a bein adam l'chaveiro aspect. Now here I do want to point out one interesting point. You know, in the ecological movement, there is what is called high ecology, and there is what is called low ecology. Now, it's very interesting. Low ecology primarily sees environmentalism as a matter of human relationships, meaning I want to leave the world safe and healthy for other human beings, for my children, for future generations. Memela, I'm not going to despoil the environment because I would be doing bad things for other human beings. That's called low ecology, you'll see, because that's basically saying human beings are the most important, but automatically I got to be responsible because otherwise I would be mekalkel the world for human beings. High ecology makes a much more radical claim. High ecology claims, who says human beings are so important anyway? Animals are the same as human beings. Plants are the same as animals. And therefore, the preservation of the environment is not because it's good for human beings. The preservation of the environment is the tree is just as important as you. So I just want to point out that high ecology actually blames, Jews get blamed for everything, it actually blames the Judeo-Christian, what they call the Judeo-Christian ethic, for ruining the environment. And they point because in Bereshis, when Hashem put Adam in Gan Eden, he said, Pru urvu, be fruitful and multiply, milu es aretz, fill the earth, v'kivshua, and conquer it. So they say, that's the source of the problem. Man is supposed to conquer, dominate, rule, oppress. And that is why, it is the Torah that tells man to destroy this world. But whoever makes that claim is either intentionally ignorant or intentionally distorting or ignorant, because in Perek Beis, there's another mission. We have two mission statements. The human being is given two mission statements. Mission statement in Perek Aleph is conquer and dominate. But the mission statement in Perek Beis is li'avda u'lashamra, to cultivate and to protect. And the Christians actually have a good term for this. They call it responsible stewardship. Meaning, yes, man, the human being, is the shalit, is the one that is the pinnacle of creation, the purpose of creation. But the human being has an achrayut, has a responsibility to preserve this world. So I would have to say that the Torah perspective is one of low ecology, meaning to say we have a responsibility, but it's primarily rooted in the recognition that the Adam is the Yitzir, is the Bechir of the Bria, is the pinnacle of creation, is the only creation that's B'Tselem Elokim. We do not accept any type of equivalence between people, animals, and certainly the inanimate. So we don't look at preservation of the environment as a Maila Bifnei Atzma, but in Niske Shechenim, in terms of damage to my fellow man, it is a very, very important halachic construct. And as I say, the Gemara has very, very complicated and extensive discussion about the responsibility we have to use our property in a way that's not going to damage. So we have zoning restrictions and pollution laws and traffic laws and all sorts of things like that. Let me mention some other halachas that are an okayah here. First of all, we do have special halachas regarding Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And the Ramban writes that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael does not only mean there's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, that's another machlokas, but it means there's a mitzvah that Eretz Yisrael should be beautiful, should be productive. The Alter Slobodka said when you pick up garbage that is on the ground in Eretz Yisrael, you're not only fulfilling the Bein Adam L'Chaveira of sparing people from seeing ugliness, but you are Mekayim, the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. That's why I have to tell you a story. Again, it's a little disheartening. There were some parks where people sometimes picnic on Shabbos. They rely on the Erev. But they say they can't really move the garbage off the picnic table because it's muktzah. Garbage is muktzah. And therefore they have to leave it on the table till after Shabbos. Again, l'aniyas daiti, if you take the position, again, this is a big, big shaila, that the garbage is muktzah, then I'm sorry, you'll have to give up your Shabbos picnic. What possible reshus does a person have to leave garbage in a public park? And if Hilchos Muktzah will stop them from removing it, then they can't have a picnic there. But as I say, it's not only a Bein Adam L'Chaveira. The Paiskim say there's a Kiyam, a special Kiyam. See, that would apply in Chutz Laretz too. There's a special Kiyam of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. The Gemara gives another example. Let's say I have trees, and there's a river that overflows its banks, and it sweeps away the trees, and it plants the trees on your ground. Now, logically, I should be able to claim the trees, but Chazal say, we like to encourage more tree planting in Eretz Yisrael. So instead of reclaiming your trees, the new owner has the right to pay you, and you plant new trees. So instead of four trees here, we're going to have eight trees. And the Gemara in Bava Metzia says we do that because of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. There is a din in the Torah of Orei Migrash. What is a Migrash? The Torah says the Levium were given 48 cities, but around each city there must be a vacant Shetach, these are 1,000 amas or 2,000 amas, as a machlokes, how to compute it, which has to be left as essentially parkland. Residences cannot expand. Rav Shimshon Afal Hirsch writes, this is a very modern urban planning idea, Rav Hirsch writes that the notion that you can't expand a city into a migrash, even if you'll leave other land as a migrash, is essentially a model of urban planning. That instead of having huge, sprawling communities, communities should be small and self-contained, where people know each other, they interact with each other, and you have parklands where people can enjoy nature and the like. And even though the halacha is, this is only required for Levite cities, but Rav Hirsch says, since the Levim were the teachers of Klal Yisrael, essentially, the mandatory halachas of Ari Levim are a model of the type of urban environment we should create, which is not one of urban sprawl, but one of self-contained neighborhoods that are surrounded with parklands where people could connect to the environment. And in fact, it's true, there's the Mishnah LeMelech actually brings that there were some shittas that say that all cities in Eretz Yisrael had to have a migrash. That's a very, very big chiddush. The Chumash is not mashma the way the Chumash is mashma. That migrash is a special halacha for Ari Levim. But again, the halacha is beferish. Ein oisen migrash ir. You cannot expand a city into a migrash. So what do you do when a city gets overpopulated? You got to start another city. You cannot expand it. The parkland has to be inviolate. You don't build into the dedicated parkland. Again, there's so many different halachas. I mean, Tsar Balei Chaim connects to our Rachmanis for the animal kingdom. Now, here I do want to mention, this is where high ecology and low ecology would have a very different position. You know, a high ecology would basically say that animal experimentation that brings pain to animals is absolutely immoral, even if it could result in a cure for cancer or whatever. The Jewish halacha is not as broad. In other words, the Jewish halacha basically says that human needs predominate, but it has to be a significant human need. And you minimize the pain to whatever degree possible. And that is, to do testing on animals for cosmetics, in which animals might be blinded or go through pain, to have a better deodorant or a better toothpaste or whatever it is, these chemical testing, that would be improper. In fact, there are some poskim who say the way veal, right, veal are calves that are penned up and not allowed to move, so their flesh is very tender and soft. Some have said it's a Tsar Balei Chaim issue. Because, yeah, the meat is more tender, but that is not enough of a tzorech that would justify imposing pain on animals. Mink, the way mink used to be trapped, maybe it still is, through these iron traps that cut into the flesh, and it's so painful that the animal actually gnaws off its leg to get away from the trap. Now, is that for a tzorech? Well, it's a tzorech. It's a tzorech of having a mink coat. But once again, a tzorech that is simply for a luxury that causes pain and suffering would not be justified. Now, let me point out, it is well known, and it's been a scientifically established fact for decades, if not more than a century, that shechita is an absolutely painless way of killing an animal. The world's greatest expert on animal behavior, a very fascinating woman in her own right, is an autistic woman, Temple Grandin. You may have heard of her. She actually has a doctorate in animal behavior. And it's fascinating. She writes herself that her autism somehow gave her somewhat of a greater connection to understanding how the cow or the dog actually feels. She is attuned to them almost in a supernatural way. And she really is. I mean, even academically, she is one of the world's great experts on animal behavior. It's really a remarkable story how an autistic person was able to achieve a doctorate at a university teaching position and the like. But she has studied this extensively, and she says animals do not feel any pain with shechita. There's an instantaneous loss of consciousness if it's done correctly. Sometimes it's not done correctly. And she said the only thing that scares animals is when they see animals, other animals being killed. So she suggested the design of slaughterhouses that the animal does not see the other animal. You have different circular paths and the like. Now, again, are the slaughterhouses doing it? Not necessarily, because it costs money, and that's another issue. But she does say there is nothing in shechita. Remember, for most of our history, you didn't have mass slaughtering of animals. except maybe from the Beis HaMikdash a few times a year. Most of the time it was one animal at a time. It's only in recent decades that we have this mass production of slaughtering animals, and that creates a certain pachad on their part. But for Tzar Bali Chaim, if there's a life-saving need, certainly human beings take precedence. You know, PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, is really, to some degree, it's a terrorist organization. I mean, they have bombed medical clinics which were doing animal experimentation for necessary medicine, and they have killed human beings in the course of so-called animal liberation. And philosophically, PETA is based on the teachings of Peter Singer, who happens to be Jewish, but Peter Singer is a very radical bioethicist who actually says people are no better than animals and it's immoral to give human beings a preference over animals. He is really the guru of what you might call high ecology. In fact, he calls any preference of a human being over an animal is called speciesism. Just as there's racism, there is speciesism. Why do you prefer a human being over an animal? And the like. And that's why, one of the suicide bombing, or one of the bombing missions of the terrorists, they used a donkey to carry a bomb, and the donkey got blown up. So PETA issued a protest. So for all of the times when, you know, human beings are blown up, they didn't have any machah at all. And of course, they had no machah about the children that are blown up in a suicide bombing. But when the donkey was involved, so, al tigu b'mashicha, don't touch our donkeys. Again, the donkey is lo Hashem. I don't blame the donkey for anything, but still, the concern for the donkey more than the concern for the human being. So we see we have kama v'kama halachas. And of course, a lot of environmentalism is connected to another set of halachas, and that is we're not allowed to engage in behaviors that are sakana. Right? So if there are behaviors that introduce carcinogens, pesticides, there are issues of sakana involved. Now here, again, we don't have the time for a full lumdus here, but I do want to point out that the halachas of sakana are extremely complicated, and they are connected very much to science. Let me explain why. To make a statement, you're not allowed to engage in dangerous behavior, is on one level a true statement, but on the other level, it's a nonsensical statement. Every single behavior is dangerous. Are you allowed to drive? Are you allowed to go on a bus? Are you allowed to walk? Well, even if you're going to tell me, okay, I'll just stay in bed, that could be dangerous as well. Just 2 or 3 years ago, a young boy in a very dangerous neighborhood in Washington, D.C. was killed. There was crossfire of drug gangs outside, and a bullet went through the very flimsy wall, and the kid got killed in his bed. So everything is dangerous. What does it even mean to say, don't do dangerous things? So obviously, we qualify the definition with a word that is not so helpful. Don't do unreasonably dangerous things. Reasonable dangers, you're allowed to do. Unreasonable dangers, you're not allowed to do. But what's an unreasonable danger? So here the halacha kind of says, well, whatever people regard, it's a very amazing thing. It's we define the halacha. The halacha doesn't have an external definition here. Whatever people regard as the normal way, whatever most people regard as a normal way of living life, you're allowed to do, even if there's danger, based on the pasuk in Tehillim, Shomer Pisayim Hashem. Hashem protects foolish people. So since most people accept driving, going on a bus, walking in the street as normal behaviors, that's not called sakana, halachically. That which people still regard as, that's why cigarette smoking, they said that may have been the difference. But before the dangers were widely acknowledged, it was halachically mutter to smoke, even if I thought it was dangerous. On the other hand, when it becomes more makubal, Yesh v'yesh. I'm not saying it's usher. I'm not giving you a psak, but people have said that, some poskim have said that Tzitz Eliezer said it would be usher. But here is where you get the tremendous problem. The tremendous problem is Mark Twain once said, there are damn lies, and there are statistics. Meaning statistics can be the most extreme form of lying. And let me explain why. Cigarettes is actually a very good example of how statistics can reframe an issue in different ways, and depending on how you describe it, you'll have a different halakhic conclusion based on how you describe it. Now, I'm going to make up numbers because I don't have the exact number, but the point is a central point. You can have something that says the following. If you don't do this dangerous behavior, you have a 1 in a million chance of getting an illness. If you engage in this behavior, you have a 1 in 100,000 chance of getting it. Let's assume we have such a metzias. So I'm going to describe this phenomenon in two ways, and then you'll see how you feel about it based on the description. If you engage in this behavior, your chances of getting a life-threatening illness are increased 10 times. That sounds pretty bad, meaning it's 10 times more likely I'll get sick. That sounds bad. On the other hand, if I simply say, 1 out of every 100,000 people has a detrimental effect, maybe that doesn't sound so bad. And if I change it instead of 1 million to 100,000, 10 million to 1 million, right? It's like they say, you know, people say, why are we so critical about the Muslim world? No more, 95% of the Muslims are peace-loving people. Well, that's very wonderful. Even if it's true, and I'm not saying it is even true, but you know, when you have 1 billion Muslims, 5% is a mighty large number. It's much larger than the population of the Jewish people in the world. You know, so here's the thing. Statistics. 95% of the Muslims are loving, peaceful people. Or I could say, there are 1 million terrorists in the world who want to kill you, wipe you out, or 10 million. 10 million terrorists who want to wipe you out. Or 50 million people want to kill you. That sounds pretty bad. So in Sakana, I just want to point out that a lot of times, even with cigarettes, it's the same thing. Most people who smoke are not going to get lung cancer. Most people. On the other hand, the magnitude of the risk is much, 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 much greater. So the halachic issue, which I'm not going to paskin for you here, is, do we assess sakana behavior based on the magnitude of risk or on its absolute occurrence? Meaning, am I looking at how much of a multiplier it is, or am I looking at objectively what will happen? And another aspect is cost-benefit. Let's take pesticides. Let's say by using a certain pesticide, we can increase a crop yield 50 times in Africa, let's say. So, on the other hand, the pesticide increases a cancer rate. Well, so I could say, well, no good, because people will die from the cancer. But if I don't use it, people will die of starvation. Right? So you can't even ask, is something a sakana, unless you determine that not using it might be a greater sakana. Right? Cost-benefit. Now, what this tells me is that halachic determinations are very much dependent on scientific understanding of the metzias. And without good science, you can't have good halachic. This is garbage in, garbage out. The psak halacha is going to be erroneous if it doesn't understand the scientific facts. And sometimes the scientific facts are not going to be clear. But putting all of this together, again, there's much more to talk about. And maybe, I'm not sure, maybe I'll talk about this for the next week or so just to finish it up, even though it won't be too bishvat, is that environmental consciousness in one way or the other is very much it is a core of the Jewish experience. It is a core in terms of our appreciation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a spiritual way. It is connected to Bein Adam L'Chaveiro in terms of the laws about using our property not to damage other people. In terms of the laws of sakana, in terms of how we look at Tsar Balei Chaim, right, a Jew has to have this environmental consciousness. Let me just mention Bekitzer, that number one, as I said, it is a way of coming to love and appreciate Hashem. But although we do disagree with the high ecology that says the earth itself has a chashivas, I do want to say that there is some idea in Judaism that we owe a hakara satov even to the inanimate. This finds its expression. In fact, one expression was in the Makos. You remember that Moshe Rabbeinu was not allowed to be the one who turned the Nile into blood. It had to be Aaron. Because the Gemara says, the well from which you drank, you don't spit into. The Nile saved him. He had a certain debt of Hakara Satov. By the way, I even heard that when Rabbi Yashiv was asked to sign a proclamation ushering the internet, he refused because one time somebody gave him a Marim Makom from the internet that he was not aware of. He says he can't usher it because there was a tshuva from the native Yehuda that he had not, for some reason, he had not been aware of, and somebody got it off the internet. Okay. But we find the idea of challah, right? You don't, that on Shabbos, you cover up the challah. And one of the reasons is not to embarrass the bread, because there's a certain hakara satov to the bread. Normally you make hamotzi first. On Friday night you make kiddush first. The bread gets embarrassed, whatever that means. And I owe hakara satov to the bread. Shlolo vayesh esapas. We find a halacha that David HaMelech, not halacha, but the Chazal say, David HaMelech was shivering. David HaMelech was cold towards the end of his life because he treated garments with disrespect when he cut Shaul's garment, and to show Shaul that he could have killed him, etc. And if you're mavazes habegadim, right, so you have to treat begadim with gratitude, because once again, begadim help you, right, etc. So there is, at least on some level, the notion of gratitude, even for the inanimate. So although we don't accord the earth any autonomous chashivas per se, but the midah of hakara satov we do have, and that would apply to not despoiling the beauty of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then, of course, let me just mention that the Gemara tells us the story about intergenerational responsibility. One of the kings of France, was it Louis XV, the king at the time of the French Revolution, said, après moi le deluge, the 16th, after, whichever, this goes back, the 14th already, but he said, after me, let there be the flood. I don't care what happens after me. But a Jew cannot look that way. We do have an achrayas for future generations. We have an achrayas in Ruchnius, of course, to create the chinuch and the institutions that will help future generations. And we have an achrayas even begashmius. The Gemara tells us about Chayni HaMagal, that is our Rip Van Winkle, that he slept for 70 years. And you know what happened was he encountered somebody planting a tree that took 70 years to produce fruit. And he said, old man, you're going to die way before this tree ever produces fruit. What are you doing? And he said, my grandparents planted a tree for me. I will plant a tree for my grandchildren. And Chayni HaMagal fell asleep for 70 years. And he wakes up and he sees a man who looks just like the man who planted the tree, harvesting the fruit, and said, how are you getting the fruit so fast? He says, what do you mean so fast? My grandfather planted this tree. And Chayni understood what that was. We have an achrayas to try to give a world that's not going to be makokal. Yes, Hashem did promise he would not destroy the world. So people ask the question, could we destroy the world? Maybe not. First, it's not even so clear. Hashem won't bring a flood, but maybe we could destroy the world. But even if we can't destroy the world, so what? You can have a lot of things. You know, we could be living in caves, meaning a lot of things can happen that are not destroying the world. But life could be very, very miserable, and we have an achrayas to try to preserve that world that way. Let me just end with two statements. One is Gemara in Bava Kamma. The Gemara in Bava Kamma says, a certain man was taking stones from his field, and he was throwing them into the Rishus HaRabim, throwing them into the public domain. So a Rav went by, and a Chacham went by and said to him, why are you taking rocks from property that is not yours and putting it in property that is yours? So he said, what are you talking about? I'm doing the opposite. What happened was the guy didn't pay his taxes. The Roman government confiscated his property. They sold it to some guy who paid off the tax bill. That guy now has a nice field without any rocks. And this man is wandering the streets looking for a place to live or sleep. And he's stumbling and tripping on the very stones he put into the world. And now he said, now I understand. I cleaned up that property that wasn't mine, and I'm stumbling and tripping and hurting myself on the only property I have, which is the public street. So we have to know that when we harm other people, it all ultimately comes back to harm us. And the second one is a very famous medrash. The medrash rabbi says, when I could, on the pasuk li'avdo l'shamra, to cultivate the garden and to work the garden, when Hashem put Adam HaRishon in Gan Eden, He said, I'm giving you a beautiful garden. It is your job to protect it and preserve it, because if you are mekalkel it, there is no one who will come after you to make it good. And that's really a motto that we should think about. So I wish you all a very, very happy Tu B'Shvat. Yeah.
Two things.
Yeah.
There's a minhag, at least that I read about, and I took it upon myself, to have, when my mother was coming up, 15% to B'Shvat.
Because of 50,
you say, and there's a minute to say,
That's very, it's a very beautiful custom. I'm not aware of it, but I'll check it.
I'm not aware of it.
But that makes a lot of sense, but I'm not aware of it in particular. I know the 12 and the 30.
I learned that
somewhere. Okay, it makes sense.
Oh, you're familiar with that.
But I'm not familiar with that, but I'll try to check it.
Isn't, when the halachic basis is of Tu B'Shvat, isn't all included in Marashon? You didn't mention all of it.
Yes. You are correct. That is very true. That when you plant a tree, the years of Orla are counted Tishrei. But after the third Tishrei, you have to wait till Tu B'Shvat. So it's not three Tu B'Shvats. It's three Tishreis have to pass, and then after the third Tishrei, the fruit is still Orla until Tu B'Shvat.
And then it's revived.
And then it's revived from Tu B'Shvat to Tu B'Shvat. That is correct. You are correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Various different fruits and vegetables that start at different times of the year.
Yep.
Is that tied in?
Okay. Okay, that's a very excellent question, and that is a machlokas rishainim. But lahalacha, we paskin, Tu B'Shvat has no relevance for Shemitah. Shemitah is exclusively Tishrei to Tishrei. So you are right.
But they say certain fruits you don't consider under Shemitah until a certain. After Rosh Hashanah.
Well, that's because it depends on when they blossom. The blossoming or the budding is still going to be Koveya, but it's not going to be a Tu B'Shvat. It'll be, yeah. Okay, if Marv, you have enough, Marv.